Dear listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that was secretly doing Sean behind Vicky's back the whole time. Sorry, Martha. I'm Nathan.
I'm James.
I'm Todd.
And I'm two buckets of Nembutal in a red dress with a cocked pistol for this one.
Well, it's been an entire year since our last episode, and we've been going from house to house telling everyone we meet about how much we all owe to the work of Eric Saward. Have our efforts been in vain? Let's find out as we discuss the Series 3 finale, Last of the Time Lords. I can't decide whether you should live or die, or you'll probably go to heaven. Please don't hang your head and cry. I wonder why my heart feels dead inside.
So we open 1 year later.
So Russell says that he got this idea from Battlestar Galactica, I think. And so you might remember that Battlestar Galactica has this incredible thing which happens. It doesn't even happen at a commercial break or at a season finale or, you know, in between episodes. It happens in the middle of an act where Gaius Baltar puts his head in his hands and then it's a year later. And it's wonderful. I mean, it's such a great idea. And I think Russell says no one watched Battlestar Galactica in England, so he could afford to do it on his lovely show, which millions and millions of people were watching every Saturday.
You're so joyous about this fact. I am not. I loved it on Battlestar Galactica. Up to this point, very few shows like these days. We've got, like, in the last 10 years, so many shows do time jumps all around the place. It's just become ad hoc in any American thing. But up to this point, you know, it's a science fiction concept. The moment I saw it, I just went, oh, great. We're going to have a Voyager reset button happening, and it just put me off the entire episode.
Oh, but come on. We must have known there was a reset button happening by the end of last week's episode.
I think the giveaway was Bobby Ewing in the shower.
Yeah, that's right.
With John Sims and Lucy. Yeah.
The rest of the show isn't going to continue after a tenth of the Earth's population has been destroyed, which happens at the end of the previous thing. And we've seen the Paradox Machine, and I think if we have our wits about us, we didn't mention the Paradox Machine last week.
The red wedding TARDIS.
Well, well, I didn't have my wits about me, right? Yeah. And so the Paradox Machine just went over my head.
Yeah.
Like, and it still goes over my head. I mean, I see that it's there. It's all, Russell has got everything set up. You said last week, you know, people complain about him just making it up on the spot. But this time around, it is actually all plotted out so that we're going to be able to get to an end where the Master doesn't just jump into his TARDIS, which happens to be in the corner as a grandfather clock, right? There are consequences, and we know that their companion is getting written out, right?
Yeah.
So he's actually moving all the elements to an end. But I just loathe 1 year later. It's a personal thing, and it's one of many little things in this episode that for me take the shine off where it's going, right? And they just annoy me, right?
So I think it's a good idea, and I think the reason is that it gives the Master's victory a chance to stick. So the Master's victory lasts for a long time and has a massive effect on the world. So it enables the scale of the Master's victory to be something that we've never, ever seen before. So it's a little bit like the Dalek invasion of Earth, where we arrive and the Daleks have been in control of Earth for a long time. And we get to see that here. We get to see the Master have a massive effect on the world. And so the scale of what he's able to achieve wouldn't have been possible. And that makes the stakes so much higher. And I do think that the reset button, which, as we said, is just inevitable from the moment that he destroys a tenth of the world's population last week, is earned, and it's not a proper reset button because it still happened. As Francine says at the very end, all of those things still happened. I remember them.
Oh.
And so it's the effect that it has on the characters that we care about that means that it's not all thrown away. You know, very often on Voyager, as you say, Todd, they'll have an adventure and no one remembers it except us, the audience, and so who cares? But here it has a massive devastating effect on Martha and her family and, as a result, the Doctor.
I don't disagree with you, like, in that thing. I just don't feel it. I don't feel the effect on the mother. I don't feel it. When they say, like, Martha's the only person to get out of Japan alive, I just rolled my eyes and went, yeah, okay, Yeah, you're making your point that, you know, this is the devastating thing, but we're not really going to see that. You know, Martha's walked the earth. What we see is a budgetary constraints where she walks on a beach and we get a flashback to her beach and we get a flashback to the one lot of room that she sits in to talk to people.
Yeah.
Like, we don't see all those things. We get told about it. And that's, as I said, it's a budgetary thing here where you don't get to see all those things where I really want to see that to really feel it, and I don't feel it.
So what Russell does instead is he does some representative bits of that. So we get to see what her life is like, not by spending a year going around with her, and, you know, some spin-off media will do that later, but we get to see sort of what that must have been like. And, again, you know, the master is always risking being cute and cuddly because the job of the master is to make us like him or her more than we like the doctor. And the master is often successful at that. Missy is a past mistress at it. We love her enormously, and she is much more fun even than Capaldi's doctor, I think.
I'm sure she's a past master.
Yes, she is a past master at it. Not yet. She's a future master at it. So having him kill everyone in Japan, having him devastate the world and reduce them to sort of slave workers helps Russell to make his political point, you know. That,
at a distance.
Yeah. Well,
it's not High Wycombe, is it?
But it is. It's neoliberalism, you know, turning the world into a machine for manufacturing things to give power to a small number of people.
That's a beautiful point. It's exactly what this master is.
Mm. Well, it's late stage capitalism in apotheosis.
Mm, yeah, no, that's it.
It's like I'm in the room, yes.
And so I just think that it creates an enormous scale for what the master does. And we had to go up. It was so hard not to do that. Not just because the previous two finales were the end of the world, as I said in the intro of last week's episode, but because the master had, you know, tried to invade Earth so many times with the help of another alien race. He really had to win once.
Oh, totally agree.
Well, Toya Wilcox wasn't available and the Teletubbies were already signed up.
Well, they were in last week's episode, actually.
So quite early on in the episode, we get the Doctor, Francine, Jack, Tish and Clive trying to stage a coup against the master, which ultimately fails with this number three. And it's alluded that this is not the first time they've tried this.
No, but it's a heist, and that's really fun. So it gives us, it reminds us who all of these characters are, that they haven't been completely cowed by the master, but it does tell us how
Michael Caine would have done it if he was posited into this film. Yeah. Not a lot of people know that. My God, it's the Italian Job.
It's wonderfully in fun. The middle of
this. It's quite cleverly also setting up the whole countdown concept that Martha uses at the end of the episode. They do the three because they're at 3 o'clock. They are going to try this, and so it's setting up. Watch the clock.
Yeah, because later on there's a big countdown to the sort of giant attack that the master's going to launch on the rest of the universe from Earth. And it gets people to do their shtick, and it also kind of justifies a really wonderful scene, I think, with the Jones family when they're all in prison afterwards and they're all there talking about killing the master. And Francine and Clive do this kind of, you know, the kiss where they're kind of, you know, they've turned evil and so they're sort of back together. They're going to kill the master, all three of them. Even Tish will kill the master given the chance. And they do a sort of wonderful conspiratorial kiss, Clive and Francine. And it sells, I think, what's coming up later, which is the fact that Francine very nearly kills the master and is rescued from that by the doctor.
It also sells the impact that this year has had on these characters.
Yeah.
It's damaged them quite a lot.
Look how Todd feels.
Thanks, Richard.
And he was just watching it. But it sells the fact that Martha has to leave the doctor, even if, you know, the whole I'm in love with you and you don't want me thing aside, she has to leave because she has to look after her family.
And
Yeah. She's a doctor.
And that's the first thing we ever saw her do.
She's the doctor, yes.
Yeah, that's
she
the first thing.
She becomes the doctor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first thing we ever see her do is to try and prevent Clive from bringing Annalise to Leo's party.
Whatever happened to Annalise?
Wow, I would have loved to see her maid's uniform.
It's the cruelest thing that she's not in this, yeah, really, yeah. Or in a Toclophane head. Maybe she's floating around in a Toclophane mirror ball up there, you know. Banging away to the Rouge Continuum or whatever it is. I've got a question, though. Do we know under what religion Russell was brought up? Was it Welsh Baptist?
I don't know.
The Church of Harry Secombe? There's a lot of New Testament references in this, would you not say?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not even getting to when it all goes up to the post-Revelations Andrew Lloyd Webber moments at the end.
Yeah, well... I think Russell, and we've observed this before even this year, where Gridlock is largely about religion. I mean, it's also about capitalism too, but it is, you know, to a great degree about religion and has some very obvious Protestant religious elements in it. And this one here has a religious resolution where it's faith. You know, the master mocks Martha and says, so that's your solution, is it? Prayer. And prayer works. The faith of these people actually works.
See, I think that's where Russell's continuum or where Russell's position falls down, because I can see Russell talking to Matt Groening about just put a whole panel of thoughts and prayers buttons in front of Homer, and then get or in front of Mr. Burns, and then give him the do nothing button, because I really believe that after if this can be paralleled to the shootings in the US, of which what day is it now, Russell, I'm really surprised and that's the one point of this. I wonder if that's something that has annoyed Todd in the way that it was. Perhaps disappointing in how this was brought about. I really like where he's coming from, and I'm actually quite serious about that. Has he come from that Welsh church background, which is a little bit Methodist in a way that it's very much this collective can do attitude. You know, we will keep a welcome in that hillside.
I think that there is something about the resolution that is very human. So we get this feint, don't we? And we will talk in more detail about Martha's quest and so on. But what we think the quest is about it's like a science fiction quest to collect bits of a gun to assemble, and so that Martha can shoot the master in the head and he can't regenerate. And I think we should be uncomfortable about that when we hear about it, but I'm not sure that we are. And part of the reason is that the situation is so incredibly desperate. Like, you know, this is the worst things have ever got, perhaps in a Doctor Who episode, apart from what, Inferno episode 5 or whatever, when the world's on fire. Things are very bad. And so maybe in that situation, Doctor Who thinks we have to shoot the villain in the head for once. And then we discover that that's not what's happening, and what it is that saves us isn't the Doctor does something really clever, although he plays his part and he's a focus of it. It's human faith and it's human solidarity. It's that these people hope that there's a better story than we just shoot the villain in the head. And that's Doctor Who. You know, that's the ethics of Doctor Who. Now, it turns out Lucy just shoots the villain in the head anyway, so it is a little bit, it's a little bit of a cheat.
My God, it is The Simpsons.
But I think that this is Russell at his most Russell-y, because Russell, as you said last week, Richard, it's impossible to overstate how cynical and bleak Russell can be in his darkest moments. And we saw that in Years and Years. We saw it in Cucumber. We saw it, all the way back, I think, to Queer as Folk. There were really sort of terrible sort of nihilistic elements in that. We'll go on to see it next year in, I think, Midnight and Turn Left. You know, his stuff can be incredibly bleak, but here he goes for the human response. We don't just have, Jesus, Doctor, resurrected by the power of prayer and glowing and all of that. And all of that's sort of slightly embarrassing. And I'm sure that Todd would agree with me about that. But the fact that the solution comes from people and that it's about talking, it's about doing what we've done all our lives. What this podcast is about is telling people about Doctor Who, and it's talking about the Doctor as a hero and aspiring to be like the Doctor that saves the situation. And so I love it, I feel like I had my own small part in the master's downfall. Yeah.
Saving the world with the power of podcasting.
Yes, exactly.
One pair of earbuds at a time.
I like the idea. Like the idea. I find the execution of it a little more clunky than perhaps what you do. I find that we don't get to see Martha really walking the earth.
No.
She gets to be hidden using the key. But her brother is also hidden. He hides away from the master, right?
With Annalise.
Through the power of Annalise.
Say it three times, it's a big Finnish series.
Yeah, yeah.
he manages to do it without that special power. He can just hide by himself, right?
It's called fame. He's too popular to be in the show.
Very true. I'm just saying it's just a little thing for me.
Yeah, I agree.
I love Francine's storyline all the way through.
She makes this work.
She really makes it work. And when she collapses into the doctor's arms at the end for that brief moment, it's like, oh, I wish there could be just a little bit more. But you then get that lovely, when she looks out the window, that sort of begrudging sort of thing, yeah, we've been through this together. I respect you. You respect me.
I love that.
And that is so powerful.
Yeah.
We also get, and you're going to explain this to me, Nathan, because I know that you'll have an answer, right? So in the previous episode, the doctor whispers something to Martha, right, which seems to take about how many seconds?
Yeah.
10.
Oh, if that.
If that. And so in those 10 seconds, does he then tell her you're going to correct me because I'm obviously wrong, that she needs to walk the earth to tell the story and she needs to be at this point at a certain time because there's going to be a countdown and at the same time come up with some other means to sort of
yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Oh, no, I agree.
And so it's like, what has he said to her like that makes all this happen? She's obviously a resourceful woman, and so there's the whole four potions gun plot thing, which is not his idea, but at this time, on this day, in a year, and at the same time, he recognizes that he's going to be able to tune himself into this the network, and so then, you know, at that point in time, he'll be able to undo the Dobby Doctor through magic and sort of be this floating Kai figure that is Kai. Like Rose from Series One. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like all these little things that I've just mentioned just set me off. Like I'm shaking right now in this room, listener. That they just. It undermines what I think is a really good concept. Like, it just hasn't quite got it for me. Like, I'm sorry.
It's
not what Christopher H. Bidmead would have done. No,
I just think that it needs to hang together long enough for us to get to the end of the episode. And I think that, I mean, we've had a lot of time to ruminate on this. And I think that, you know, there is some sort of fridge logic where he just hopes we don't press it too hard. But, I mean, Doctor Who's been doing that, you know, ever since it began. And I think it just sort of needs to work on a sort of level of themes and spectacle, I think. And so I don't know what the Doctor says to her, and you know, he couldn't sort of possibly tell us. Maybe he just said, tell people about me and be back here on such a date or something, but how would he even know that? And I mean, the clever thing is the Archangel Network, which has the perfect name, doesn't it? Which is being used by a Time Lord to hypnotize all of humanity, and the Doctor sort of counters it and uses it against the Master, which is absolutely classic Pertwee defeating Delgado, isn't it?
I love the Archangel. This is the one thing in this rewatch that I actually really do like.
Yeah.
All of that.
They could have easily had a couple of scenes where, you know, when they're trying to defeat the Master with the whole, you know, like 3 o'clock thing, why not have had that them getting some information out to Martha? Like, I mean, there could have been a way of explaining that, you know, they had actually been conspiring with her the entire time, which would fix that issue.
Yeah. I mean, I think that any solution, and usually the solutions to things about RTD plots that annoy people, normally the solution to that is, why couldn't we have this exposition scene? And I know that's not what you're asking for here, but he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to have the exposition scene, and he wants us to find out at the same time as the Master finds out. He wants us to believe the story about the gun Okay. Yeah. Don't you think? I think that he really
Yes. No, I definitely thought that's where they were going.
Yeah.
My further problem with all of this is that we get, for most of the episode, Freema has to act, or Martha is acting, keeping herself very much her emotions to herself.
Yeah.
And I mentioned many moons ago, I had this perception of Martha blank face.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Being quite restrained and wooden.
And wooden. And I realized watching this is the episode that I get it from, because it's so unlike Martha in every other situation.
Yeah.
Even when she's protecting the Doctor before World War One in the family of blood, she's still emoting. She's still showing her true character. Whereas here, for so much of the episode, it's just this blank wall. And it's a great performance, but I just struggle with it because I don't feel emotionally invested. When she sits down in that house to tell those people about the Doctor, I feel like she could be saying, he cooked a great hamburger and you should eat those hamburgers because the cows were out in the field and it was all lovely. Like my care factor is literally close to zero. And I know that's unfair on whether it's the writing, the performance, or the direction, the fact that we get that one sequence in the recap where I think there should be more scenes with different types of people in different situations, it all compounds me. And then we get the Toclophane. When they open the Toclophane, like, we then get, oh, yes, they're all a hive mind, so they all know about Crete. And is it supposed to be Crete? Like, no, it's not.
No.
But but to me, it gives the impression that through the eyes and that sort of thing and her reaction that it is like that, and I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, no, and I think that he walks up to the edge of that. He didn't want to have the little kid who won a competition to be the guest star in Utopia end up being a shriveled head in a ball.
But that's what I feel.
Yeah, and so he gets as close to that as possible by having him say the skies are full of diamonds or something like that.
Correct.
But then we get a line saying, no, we all share the same memory. So we know it's not that. We know, but we do have Crete ending up like that. That's the really, really dark thing about it. And it's as dark as Doctor Who has ever gone, because Utopia, we talked about this 2 weeks ago. There's something incredible about the setup for Utopia, which makes it kind of emblematic about the human condition. You know, we all face some kind of mortality. Many of us spend much of our lives trying to escape it or forget about it or mitigate it or do something, trying to make our lives mean something in the face of the end of everything. And these people look like, you know, there's a moment of triumph where the rocket ship goes off, heads to Utopia, and they've escaped and we're excited. And what's in Utopia? It's, you know, the planet Mustafar with less CGI, and everyone just turns themselves into a sort of bouncing robot head. You know, like, it's horrible. It's really as bleak as Russell's ever been. There's no escape from death, and they turn themselves into monsters in order to try and escape it.
And that's never solved. That's never solved.
No, and he's not going to solve it. Yeah, that's it.
Like the ultimate end to the human race is death.
Yeah.
They're stuck at the end of the earth. They're going to die. There is no salvation.
No.
It is actually never resolved.
No.
We are in a loop, but no, that's still how it ends.
Well,
and there's no St. Francine to save us.
So the loop gets broken. So the point of the paradox machine is, of course, it permits the grandfather paradox to take place, where you can go back in time and kill your ancestors and still exist. That's why we have the paradox machine, so that the Toclophane don't wink out of existence.
Kill this hit show.
Yeah, after killing all of these people. Yes. And so it's snaps back, it's solved, but it's what isn't solved is what you say, James. The ultimate fate of humanity is disgusting and horrifying, and we turn ourselves into monsters at the end of all things. And it's like the end of, you know, series 3 of Blake 7, where we all turn into the tar and wood beast, you know.
The Tarrant wood beast.
The Tarrant wood beast. Title. And and this is much worse than that. Much worse than that.
Much worse.
And even worse than, you know, the Master killing huge swathes of the population and turning us into a giant missile base to kill everyone else with. Turning, you know, the West into this giant military machine whose job is basically to launch missiles to kill other people remotely. You know, much worse than that is the fact that everyone will die and there's no escaping it.
We were using drone tech in Afghanistan back then. Russell doesn't miss much.
No. It's really amazingly, amazingly dark.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm still struggling with the whole paradox machine thing because it goes back to something like Day of the Daleks, which I always struggle with, where, you know, by coming back in time, they've created the paradox that they blow up the house and all that sort of
thing. But they have a TARDIS, so they prevent it from happening. That's what that's
for. It's 60s SF stuff. It goes back to – and you see –
that's my head in.
Good writers did it in original Star Trek. Harlan Ellison, of course, is a writer who used it a lot. Samuel Delaney used it. It's a trope that – I think it might actually work better in fiction when you've got 400 pages than an hour's TV.
And it has to be the sort of thing that the Master does, because the Master can't just be a guy in a nice suit who does conspiracies. He has to be a Time Lord, and so he has to play with time. And so the Paradox Machine enables him to do that. And have a think too, we just alluded to this earlier on about Lucy. Like, the reason that Lucy is why she is because she's seen Utopia. The Master took her to see Utopia, and she realized that everything dies, everything ends, and therefore nothing matters.
He took her to break her.
But that's what he's like. You know, he's motivated by – we said this last week. I talked about it last week. He's motivated by being the agent of time in the sense that he destroys things. He's the ultimate end of everything. And so to make her his henchman, he shows her that truth. It's Russell is, you know, for all of that jolliness, for all of that, everything's marvelous and wasn't everything wonderful and all those Doctor Who confidentials where he was, you know, so excited by everything.
As he kicks over a sandcastle.
And it's all for the kids.
Hey, kids, one day everyone you love will be dead and so will you.
I have to pray. John Sim.
Yeah.
And I have to praise
very much so,
Lucy for their performances in this episode. I believe that it is an absolute tour de force for him, and I, without him, for me, this episode would have fallen to pieces. And because he's acting against the Dobby Doctor, and I know that happened because David Tennant was filming other things and they needed to go there, but I absolutely hate the Dobby Doctor beyond I just really dislike it. Right? I love the moment when John Sim sneaks up behind the doctor.
He's in the cage and he's in his dressing gown and he sneaks in like on tiptoe into the room. Yeah. It's wonderful.
But his whole performance through this, where the doctor tries to say things to him and he stops him all the time, and then obviously at the end where he is shot and refuses to regenerate, he's just phenomenal throughout that whole thing. And Russell has thought through all these things, right? I love the fact that he's not going to be locked up on an island with a governor, right? He's going to escape in a clock to come back again. But he's got the whole get out of jail card with the ring that's picked up out of the fire. I think that's all it all ties it together. And I think John Sim's performance acting against nothing, dealing with the family, and then Lucy, just the battered wife syndrome.
I think
all of that is just amazing. That's the aspects of the episode that I really connected with and helped me get through.
I think the battered wife thing is actually maybe just slightly too dark for Doctor Who, but it is not overplayed. Yeah. I also really like, there's a moment, you know, when the Dobby Doctor first emerges, like crawls out of David Tennant's suit, and then the Master gives this look like he's seen how crap the special effect is and he's slightly embarrassed on the Doctor's behalf, which I think is great. Look, this season, and we've said it over and over again. We've said it over and over again. They reach further than they can grasp, special effects wise. And I would sooner they did that than be timid. I would sooner endure a crappy special effect than a lack of ambition. And so the Dobby Doctor doesn't really work. It looks nothing like David Tennant. It's really slightly embarrassing.
In fact, that's actually one of the most Doctor Who things about Series 3 is that Doctor Who has always reached further than the special effects could manage. Look at the CSO in the 70s.
Yeah, no, that's why we love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the ambition of the of it to make something brilliant even when you don't have, you know, two pennies to rub together.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, he basically takes over the show. It's the absence of David Tennant apart from a voice, and the big thing that's fun to watch is John Sim as the Master. He's just tremendous.
He is tremendous. The other two people I really love in this episode are Tom Ellis, who is Tom Milligan. I cannot go past his performance. That's what I'm talking. Well, if you watch Lucifer, then you'll know his performance just gets better and better. Really,
most of us paused abruptly when he appeared on the screen. What does he play in Lucifer?
Lucifer.
That's him.
Yeah.
He has done well for himself.
Hasn't he has indeed. And the other person is John Barrowman, who I think does a really stellar performance.
He really does.
Jack.
Yeah, Tom Milligan's really great. Let's talk about that little bit that going to see the Toclophane reveal with Alison Doherty, Professor Doherty. I just think that is so well told, so economically told. You know, it's the sort of thing that would have taken easily an episode or two in the classic series, but they just sort of rush in. Everything's told really super economically. Then we get the sort of giant reveal, and then we humanize it with Professor Doherty, who I just think is an amazingly good character with her, you know, pining for Countdown and all of that.
I hate the fact that at the end Martha goes and gives her flowers.
I loved that.
No, yeah. I hate it.
Why?
Because it just doesn't ring true to me. She didn't actually do those things.
But she did.
But yeah. She didn't.
It happened.
No, it didn't.
But in the bubble universe, it happened.
Yeah.
She had that potential in her, as we all do, when your family is threatened.
Yeah.
You will do anything to save
her. I think that's the message.
But I think Martha knows that, and so that's just about Martha forgiving her. I think that there's something humane about that. Our response to the Master is to want to kill him with a big gun. Alison Doherty betrays Martha and has her delivered to the Master, and it just shows us some forgiveness. And I actually quite like the sort of little baffled, you know, I quite like seeing her what her life is like without that year. Do you know what I mean? She's an academic at university. She's happy. It's really our only chance to see the world set right again, you know, because the world isn't set right really properly for the people on the Valiant. So the only sign that everyone's sort of gone back to normal, I guess it's that, and then when she rings Tom in the hospital and then hangs up because she knows she can go and get him later, you know.
But she doesn't, unfortunately.
Well, maybe she does.
Look, I take your point.
Yeah.
It doesn't move me at all. I don't particularly like her performance in the show. Like, I don't think it's stellar performance. I think it's by the numbers, and I like her phoning Tom. I like that sort of thing. That's fine, but it just doesn't work for me.
She's the closest we get to a sort of a normal person reflecting on what her life has become in this year, I think.
True.
Tom Milligan point and the destruction of Milligan by Doherty is, I think, the point of redemption, and why I still assume that Russell is coming from the old Welsh Church position of, you know, forgive everything and be redeemed in turn by it. You may lose everything, but you will actually still be yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's that sort of moment of forgiveness. Like, he gets killed and the Master makes a fantastic joke. Like, it's horribly bleak, isn't it? The way that the Master kind of shoots him and then does that throwaway line about it. Oh, I've never killed anyone before. My first blood, you know, he says, and he kind of laughs and stuff. And it's horrible. Like, the Master is sort of super horrible in it. But just having it put right, you know, Tom's okay and Alison's forgiven. And we can move on. And I guess that's what Martha's job is at the end of the episode, isn't it? To kind of fix what they've experienced. Mm. It is super religious, isn't it? You know, the world has gone to hell and it's saved through faith. And
it's a very anti-Russell.
Yeah.
It's a very anti-Russell position to take, I would have thought, but perhaps not. Perhaps
Yeah,
every cynic is actually an optimist in search of the truth and redemption.
Yeah, or you know, like, he seems to have a sort of wistful kind of feeling about religion. You know, his first mention of religion is in The End of the World, where he lists it as one of the weapons that's forbidden on platform one. But Gridlock talks about religion being a positive unifying force that enables these people, all of these disparate, diverse people, to find a way of living together under really difficult circumstances. But at the same time, he sees it as a thing that prevents them from doing anything about those terrible circumstances. So he's not one way or another about religion, and he's not religious, but he's clearly interested in it, and he's happy to borrow its iconography. These are stories that, you know, permeate our culture, and even though we're all sort of, you know, in a post-religious environment, those stories are really resonant. I think that it's nice to see him kind of dip in and use them.
So, of course, Martha just happens to survive through chance, Tom running out and saving her. The Master's quite prepared to kill off a Doctor Who companion.
Yeah.
And then she just happens to get taken up to the craft just in time for the countdown to be going down and a series of conveniences. And she's still Martha Blankface up until the point where she begins to laugh. I find it... It's great to see that happening, but I find it so jarring after an episode of very little... For me, emotion from her, suddenly it's like this laughter. But in that moment, it reminded me of how much I really love Freema. And she's such a – this is such a Joe Grant moment. I just feel that.
Yeah.
And the fact that we then see everybody chanting the Doctor at the same time. And I'm getting chills now. I really love that moment, you know. Obviously, through this, I've been talking about all these niggles that I have, but I just want to say to people, I still like this episode, right? I still give it 7 or 7.5, but that's 2 points less than what I would give last week because of those things. But through her actions at the end, through getting rid of the Dummy Doctor, through John Sim's performance, through her mum's performance, the sheer will of the performances get me through to this point. And I think... I can't see any other way of doing it. Like, Russell has plotted everything out, right? And I think it's some of the best plotting that he's ever really done and set up. And he ties up everything. But for some reason I'm still at this point slightly unsatisfied, which is why it's not my favourite finale of these first three years. But in that moment, everybody chanting the Doctor, I think that's a magical moment. Magical.
What I think is a little bit less magical is David Tennant cradling John Sim in his arms and blubbing and pouring snot all over him and just doing his usual horrible overacting thing. I just found that all just a little bit hard to take.
This is where I think John Sim absolutely shines in that moment, and it makes David Tennant...
He's saying, I would rather die than continue this scene with you.
But making a joke out of it, but actually this comes back to what we were saying earlier about the Master's never really won, and in that moment he wins.
Yeah.
He says, well, you know, you've defeated my plan. You want to imprison me in your TARDIS for the rest of eternity. No, I get to win. I'm going to win in this situation. I'm going to die.
Yeah.
He doesn't die. He's got another plan.
Russell said it's the Rani that rescues the ring.
Yeah.
Back in the day. It ends up being Mrs. Trefusis, doesn't it? Which, of course, is Vivian Fay, isn't it?
Yes. But I think it's, you know, the governor of Wentworth, Selwock H.
It is. Definitely.
Mrs. Davidson.
Well, no, it's actually Tracy Simpson's hand.
Okay, right. And that is set up. So it does look like he wins by dying, but he does have a sort of evil backup plan.
Yeah, get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
But I like that, because so often in the original series he's like burnt to death and then no explanation as to why he's been resurrected. And I like that little touches that you can take it or leave it, but it will come back into play.
So he did escape from Castrovalva after all.
But he does get to talk about the Sea Devils and the Axons. I like all that stuff. It's very good.
Yeah.
But there's no escaping the end of the season and the departure of Martha Jones, if we can talk about this for a moment.
Yeah.
I think it's the best companion departure in New Who, having now watched 11 years. For once, somebody gets to leave on their own terms without being displaced in time, near death, you know, away from their real world. And yes, she's got a job to do, but it's her job. And the strength that she shows in that sequence, I'm just so in awe of not only the character and the writing, but the performance of Freema. And my opinion of her has just completely changed.
Well, I would tend to agree with you on that. It's like this character for the entire season has been robbed somewhat of her agency.
Yeah.
She's got a crush on this man who basically takes her for granted. And in that moment she says, no, I'm in control of my life. I'm making this decision. I'm leaving because this is my life.
I like how she gets to say it. Like initially she says, I have to leave and look after my family. And that's what she has always done. You know, she is caring in a way that Rose wasn't. And then she comes back and says, no, actually, here's why I'm leaving. And I really, really like that scene. And I kind of like it because we've talked before, I cry at companion departures. I don't cry when the Doctor regenerates particularly because they're still the Doctor. But this one I just think is amazing. And I love her coming back and telling that story. And the Doctor kind of goes, is this going anywhere? You know, where is this going? And then she makes her point and she gets to leave triumphantly. And it's a problem, you know, that the show has. Basically, the only way you can write someone out is having the Doctor lock the door on them and leave them outside the first time they meet some passing Scotsman.
Yeah. Doing the accent.
Yeah, that's right. And now that the Doctor can control the TARDIS and come back whenever he wants, why would a companion ever have to leave at all? And they went to great lengths to get rid of Billy. And this one is brilliant. She just says, nope, I'm done. I've had enough. And it's not a sort of Tegan, I can't cope with another Eric Saywood story. I've got to go.
See, yes, it's 900 stories. How many did you?
I mean, we've talked about, you know, companion departures in the classic series being a case of
Andrew Hodgson's contract roulette.
Yeah, that's right, and how so many of them are so poorly flagged and visualized, and here it is just so well done. I think I hope that obviously we've just watched the first series of Jodie. I hope that when these three companions go, that Chris takes a note of this rather than having to kill them or pseudo kill them or whatever it is, that they can leave on their own terms like this, because I just think it should have happened more than what it's happened now. But it makes it unique at this point, and that's why it's so powerful.
So is she's the only companion who doesn't leave for science fiction reasons, is that right, in the new series?
Well, I mean, look at Rose, like, so she's and an alternative thing. You look at Rory and Amy, like they've been zapped back in time so they can't see their family. I mean, she gets the choice to make, but he doesn't.
Yeah, and then Clara and Bill.
Clara and Bill. And
both travel in time together and become the Doctor and stuff.
But then dead or alive, depending on what you think.
Or a puddle. Lesbian puddle.
To me. And then, of course, Donna, the version of Donna is not the same version. Like she dies in a way. So it's why I really love this departure.
I think they always sort of play it in such a way, and they do it kind of deliberately. You know, that thing where in a companion's last episode they say, there's no way I could ever leave you ever, ever, ever sort of thing, and then they're, you know, a bird flies into them or something. you know. And so just having someone leave for normal character reasons I think is great. It's brilliant. And Martha will be back next year. She makes that quite clear. And, in fact, I think she does 4 episodes next year.
Or 5.
4 or 5 episodes. And she'll do a few Torchwoods as well. So she is back, perhaps not quite as rewardingly as we might have hoped, but she'll be back. And I think it's the best companion departure, like you, Todd. I think it's the best companion departure of the new series.
I'll go with my pick of the week. And as always, I'm going to go with a classic Doctor Who story.
Brilliant.
One which has the Toclofane of the original series, very shimmery, and I'm sure their ultimate reveal will just make you dumbfounded.
Vardens.
It's got the original space rhinos of the original series, the Zontarans. It's even got Time Lords in it, and it's got one of the best companion departures ever in the history of Doctor Who. This is how it should be done in contract roulette. It's even got a slight cliffhanger into the next series.
Yes.
With a bit of a reveal. So, of course, as we know it here, it's Tom Barker and Lois Jemison in Carry On Gallifreying, or as you all know it, The Invasion of Time.
Good choice.
I thought I was wrong. It is actually a very good story for all the reasons it shouldn't be, Invasion of Time. Maybe it's got some parallels to this one because of that as well. Maybe.
You know, it's for the companion departure, right?
Are you saying it's on parallel with this companion departure?
We've just seen how good it can be. And I think people need to go back and see, well, you know.
Dodo sends her love and hopes. Ow.
So my pick of the week is Life on Mars.
Oh, good choice.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I still think it is one of the best mystery, police procedural, supernatural, sci-fi, fantasy shows that the BBC has ever made.
And they've made a lot of them.
It shows that Matthew Graham can actually write.
Yeah.
Sorry, what else did he do for me and the listener?
Well, he did Fear Her.
And The Rebel Flesh, The Also People.
Oh, but that's very good.
Did he do The Doctor's Daughter as well? No, that's Stephen Greenwood. Sorry.
That's Neil Cage.
Cut that.
No. Oh, Neil Cage. I was thinking the doctor's wife.
We're cutting all this out. That's it makes us look like we don't know about Doctor Who.
I'm shocked that you haven't chosen a big finish.
I know. So am I. Yes, I mean, I really love Life on Mars. I think it is brilliant. And Ashes to Ashes, I think, actually improves on it. So go and watch them now.
Brilliant.
When are we doing the Life on Mars Ashes to Ashes podcast?
You just did it, darling.
Hey! That was it.
We are coming up on the 2-year mark since the yes results in the postal survey.
Oh.
And on a personal note, we're recording this on the day before, the day before my first anniversary. First wedding anniversary, and of course the first anniversary of the release of our World War III episode, just as importantly. And so what I want to recommend is a book called How Powerful We Are by Sally Rugg, who ran the marriage equality campaign. She was an activist who used to work for GetUp, and it is an account of the years of work that led up to our final victory in that horrific postal survey that was inflicted on us. It is a hard read at times, and it does bring back memories of a pretty rough few weeks, but it is absolutely, I think, worth remembering and commemorating. So that's Sally Rugg, How Powerful We Are.
It's also kind of draws a parallel to the power of the human spirit to turn the doctor into an angel.
Well, it's Martha going around the world and telling people to vote yes in the postal survey.
Exactly. My only pick of the week, and it's really little, and I think you can actually get it free, just because it's grabbed for me this week what Russell's been writing about. And because of lovely friend of the podcast, Richard Hewitt, I have subscription to the London Review of Books.
Oh.
And thank you, Richard. John Lanchester, who's one of the really good writers, talks about the case for the universal basic income.
Ooh.
And it really does feel like, oh, this is just another Russell episode if he actually stuck around. I think it's what this story has been telling us. If we simply have a structure of society that supports everyone, no matter what side of politics you come from, we could avoid the Saxons.
Mm.
Although they are fun.
They are fun.
For a little while.
Yes, it's difficult, isn't it? How much fun do you need?
Well, dear listener, we're off to hug whatever's still left of our families at this point, so that's all the time we have for this week. We'll be back next week to clear up all the mess we've made in the last few months in our Series 3 retrospective. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FDE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bonfinger and Jody into Terror. Until next time, remember that the universe ends in 100 trillion years, so you've probably got enough time for just one more Space 1999 marathon. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
Good everything.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Todd Bilby, Nathan Bottomley, James Selwood and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, strings performance by Jane Orberg. This episode, Saving the World with the Power of Podcasting, was recorded on the 22nd of September 2019 and released on the 8th of December. It took us about 12 years to come up with all that nonsense about Last of the Time Lords. If you want to see what we can come up with in just a couple of days, make sure you're still subscribed to our Doctor Who flashcast Jody into Terror, which will be starting up again in the new year. Do you know the Sean and Vicky reference that I did?
Sean and Vicky.
Nathan, I've got no idea what you just mentioned about the Sean and Vicky reference. I've got no idea.
This isn't going in. So it's Sean. Vicky is the person who was in love with Sean, the flatmate. She was in love with Sean the whole time, but he never noticed her. It's the story that Martha comes in and tells the doctor. At the end of the
That's right.
Jesus.
That's right.
Oh. So we were doing Sean the whole time behind Vicky's back is the...
Okay, thank
you. I was so proud of that.
That's very clever.
Gets my jokes. That's all right.
All right. So, director Colin Teague is back.
Hooray.
For part two. What's he done besides these two episodes?
Torchwood.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Lots and lots of Torchwood.
Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures, mostly.
Right, okay.
But no other Doctor Who other than these two episodes?
I think he comes back, doesn't he?
Oh, can we look it up?
Yeah, I think we really ought to, James. Keep talking, we can slot it
in. Well, wait, no, don't keep talking, we can't slot it in.
I'm offline.
Wiki.
All filmography.
I am almost there.
I heard a cry.
That was me.
I heard a cry.
That was
Holby City, London's Burning, Shooters, Sarah Jane, Torchwood, Doctor Who, three episodes, 2007 to 2008.
So he must have done one next year.
Being Human, Hustle.
Okay.
Maybe we can talk to that.
So this is Colin's second episode.
Yeah.
And we'll do one more next year. So we open 1 year later.